I'm pleased to introduce to you our first speaker, Dr. Kathryna Jamieson. She's an assistant professor at UCSD.
Thanks very much. I get the torch. All right. Well, it's great to be here among friends. A lot of us are stem cell biologists, but work in different capacities to try and allow regenerative medicine to fulfill its potential to help our patients. And I'd really like to thank not only our philanthropist, Mr. Sanford, to help us with these efforts locally, but also CIRM for being a tremendous proponent of stem cell research and really helping us to ask the difficult questions and hopefully answer some of them. And especially when it comes to cancer, I think that we're constantly reminded, for those of us that work in the cancer stem cell field, that this is a really important target of regenerative medicine. What we're trying to do at the Cancer Center and throughout campus, and a lot of people are working hard on this collaboratively, is to find cancer's Achilles heel. So these are pictures from the Achillean taken in Greece, and what it points out is that even Achilles, who was a consummate warrior, had his weak point. And so even though cancer can look like it cannot be overcome, it has its weak points. So I think that we can target cancer. The reason I use Achilles as a metaphor is Achilles means grief to the people in Greek. So if you look at the causes of death in this country, the number one cause of death is cancer for people under 85. So I think of it as the most lethal degenerative disease, and it's certainly something that we should target our stem cell efforts against. Now, I have been working for some time together with my lab on the cancer stem cell hypothesis, and it's sort of like finding a needle in a haystack. This theory is not new. It was first proposed in 1937. It's been around for a long time. However, the tools needed to really investigate this concept haven't really been around until very recently. And what it suggests is that there's a functional hierarchy among the cancer cells, where only a small group of cells called cancer stem cells has the capacity to regenerate itself, but also give rise to all the different types of cells within the cancer. It was first found in leukemia by John Dick and colleagues, but more recently we've been able to find it in other solid tumors. I think what really makes these cells stand out, other than their enhanced regenerative capacity, is their aberrant differentiation potential, really aberrant survival potential, and inappropriate homing. So the way I think about the cancer stem cell hypothesis, it's reprogramming, but it's inappropriate reprogramming. So there are a number of diagnostic and therapeutic challenges. As a hematologist-oncologist, I'm constantly reminded that we need to do a little bit of a better job, at least with heme malignancies. So even when you have a blockbuster drug that's a $2 billion market a year, imatinib, for a disease that's fairly rare called chronic myeloid leukemia, we don't know that we've cured anybody of that disease. We know that the majority of patients are in hematologic remission, and we're able to get rid of the fusion gene BCR-ABL, in at least by our detectable markers, but we don't know that they aren't just brewing something that's going to come back. So I'll talk about that in a little bit of detail. But the main thing in this field is we have to be able to pick up those people that do have something brewing. They have cells that have resisted our treatment, and they are developing secondary resistance mutations. So that's really important for patients. The other thing is to be able to target those cells that have become resistant to our single-agent therapy and really block their aberrant differentiation, survival, self-renewal, and homing. Now, that was the whole focus of an article in The Economist, of all journals. Think of it as a journal, because this is a huge economic issue. As we develop targeted therapy, people are starting to get back to work and starting to become more productive members of society instead of being tethered to an IV pole all the time. However, they're becoming inured to the fact that they have a potentially fatal disease. So they're starting to forget to take their pills. So that's a bit of a problem. So if we understand the initiating events, those events involved in progression and resistance, I think we'll be able to help those people that have forgotten to take their pills and have developed resistance mutations as a result. So in the lab, we've been working on the initiating events, particularly in these diseases called chronic myeloproliferative disorders. So these are sort of a paradigm for understanding how something goes from being pre-malignant to malignant, and understanding at what stage of hematopoietic development this occurs and where it's important. So in these disorders, it's really a problem of commitment. They commit too much. So in the myeloproliferative disorders, they make too many of one kind of blood cell in the bone marrow. Either too many red blood cells, and that's called polycythemia vera, too many platelets, that's called essential thrombocythemia, too many white blood cells, that's chronic myeloid leukemia, or they scar down their marrow, and that's called idiopathic myelofibrosis. Now, they have a 36-fold higher chance of clotting than the general population, and that's strokes and heart attacks. So that's a pretty big deal in and of itself. And then they have varying propensities to transform to acute leukemia. So what we'd really like to do is have far more targeted therapy for these patients, and that's been a major effort in the lab. But to be able to devise targeted therapy, we really have to understand where the molecular events happen that promote the disease. Do they happen at the level of the hematopoietic stem cell, which normally is the only robustly self-renewing cell in the bone marrow, or do they happen at a more committed progenitor level? For example, at the common myeloid progenitor, megakaryocyte erythroid progenitor, or granulocyte macrophage progenitor. And for the first part of the talk, I'll focus on the common myeloid progenitor and MEP. So I've been looking at myeloproliferative disorders for a little while as a hematologist, but it wasn't until 2005 that the JAK2 mutation was discovered. And this was a seminal discovery in terms of understanding how heme malignancies are initiated. We'd known about BCR-ABL for many years, but this was the first one that put the myeloproliferative disorders together in terms of potentially having a common root or a common derivation from one genetic mutation. So what this was a point mutation in the JAK2 gene. And when the JAK2 gene was first discovered by Andrew Wilkes in 1989, he called it just another kinase. He thought his career was over. It was a useless kinase. What am I doing? I'm getting out of science. And fortunately, he changed his mind, and he discovered many other things. But it got a more lofty title called Janus kinase. And it turned out to be one of the most essential arbiters of what a hematopoietic stem cell is going to become. So it's how the hematopoietic stem cell decides to understand the cytokine cues from the microenvironment. So it's how it decides to respond to erythropoietin to make red blood cells, or respond to GCSF to make white cells. So there were four papers published in close succession. And what they showed was that 97% of patients with PV, that propensity to make too many red blood cells, have this mutation, JAK2V617F. 50% of patients with essential thrombocythemia have this mutation, and 50% with myelofibrosis. What we found, this is when I was in Irv Weissman's lab at Stanford, was that that mutation seen in red here was expressed at the level of the hematopoietic stem cell and transmitted clonally through to the progeny, the CMP, GMP, and MEP. And the other thing we found was as people progressed in their disease, in this case polycythemia vera, they expanded the number of circulating hematopoietic stem cells as well as the number of progenitors in the peripheral blood. Now, fortunately, we live in San Diego now, and so we're surrounded by 500 biotech and pharmaceutical companies. This is a major advantage. This is not just a hotbed of basic, fantastic science, but also this is the place, if any place in the world exists, to translate things quickly. So fortunately, up the street, there was a company that happened to have a JAK2 selective inhibitor, and we started collaborating with this company, the small molecule ATP competitive inhibitor. And what we found initially in vitro, and this is work done by Ifat Giron, Anneli Abramson, and Edward Kavalerchik in the lab, was that it decreased that enhanced erythroid differentiation potential in vitro. And what we also found was it decreased the mutant allele burden, that V617F expression in vitro, and that it worked at the hematopoietic stem cell level. So in polycythemia vera, the hematopoietic stem cells really want to become red blood cells. So there's this thing called lineage priming, and the stem cells are already fated to become one thing, in part because of JAK2 overexpression. So in this case, we could get them to decrease the red blood cell differentiation potential based on the use of that drug, TG101348, in vitro. Now, this is an example of when we overexpress the mutant JAK2 gene, you can see that it really does recapitulate what we see in polycythemia vera, and that's that propensity to make too many red blood cell colonies. Overexpression of the wild type produced too many mixed colonies. And what we found when we treated the cord blood progenitors that were transduced with JAK2 was that they were exquisitely sensitive, at least the red blood cell colonies, to the effects of this JAK2 selective inhibitor. So that was interesting, but we didn't know that it would be important or even relevant in a clinical setting. So we devised this model together with Charlene Baroga to overexpress, again, either mutant JAK2, wild type JAK2, or this lentiviral backbone, together with luciferase and GFP, so that we could mark the cells and know that we've transduced them and follow them in vivo. So this is another example of how this area has made essential contributions, the people working here, particularly Roger Chen, to science, because we use these tools all the time. So another Nobel Prize winning idea out of UCSD. Anyway, we tag these cells, put them into these highly immunocompromised mice that lack T, B, and NK cells. So they have no immune system. And we transplant them at birth intrahepatically because the liver is a really rich cytokine milieu. And so that promotes hematopoietic development. Then we were able to follow engraftment using an in vivo bioluminescent imaging system. What we found using this system and a lot of oral gavage of the drug TG101348 was that we could decrease the bioluminescent engraftment of polycythemia vera progenitors tagged with luciferase or the JAK2 mutant allele expressing cord blood progenitors. We could decrease glycophorin A expression, that's a red blood cell marker, in vivo, and we also decreased the mutant allele frequency in vivo. So that's a very short synopsis of what it took to get to a clinical trial. It took 1 year from lead compound identification to clinical trial, and the reason that happened was because of teamwork. This was really a concerted effort by the people in the lab, but also through our collaborators at the company that we worked with, and in part through CIRM funding, which we were very grateful for, and also because the people that were working on the other coast at Harvard decided to tell us what they were doing. We shared ideas, and we actually published our work in back-to-back papers with Gary Gilliland at Harvard. So we had completely complementary results, and they formed part of the basis for this clinical trial. So I just had the cohort call for this clinical trial this morning. I'm the PI on the trial here at UCSD. And what this trial is aimed at doing is trying to make people's lives better who have myelofibrosis. So that's the end consequence of having JAK2 overexpression. You scar down your marrow. So we're treating these people now. It's a dose escalation study. It seems to be a very well-tolerated drug. We're looking at mutant allele burden, not just in all the cells, but actually at the progenitor level. So I think this is the beginning of something where I think patients will have more options and more control over their lives. So we're very optimistic about this study. Now, what happens when people aren't so fortunate as to be in the early stages of disease and don't just have one mutation going on? They have a number of things going on. You know the water's going to get rougher. So we chose for this question to look at a disease where people inexorably progress to acute leukemia, and that's chronic myeloid leukemia. So although that was lumped in with the other myeloproliferative disorders when they were first described in 1951, it really does behave differently because these people all progress to acute leukemia if untreated. Now, we've known that there was a characteristic chromosomal abnormality in this disease since 1960. So it was the first cancer to be associated with a characteristic chromosomal abnormality. It was later found to be fueled by the fusion gene called BCR-ABL, and then David Baltimore, George Daly, and Rick Van Etten showed that that was necessary and sufficient to allow chronic phase to be established. So when people come in chronic phase, they don't feel that bad. You know, 50% are found just on routine blood screening. A lot of them have these big spleens, but they can kind of get on with their lives. 90% of people respond to a BCR-ABL inhibitor called imatinib, and if they don't respond to that or are intolerant of that, then they've got other choices, dasatinib and nilotinib. Unfortunately, some people are intolerant of all three of those, and they progress. And it's those people that we need to understand and figure out how to stop their disease in its tracks. So what we've devised is this way of looking at patient blood or bone marrow and seeing what stage of disease they're at. Are they in chronic phase, in which case they have an expansion of the megakaryocyte erythroid progenitor population, accelerative phase, increased CMP, or blast crisis, increased GMP? Now, we know that in blast crisis, the GMP, the granulocyte macrophage progenitor population, really highly amplifies the BCR-ABL fusion gene. So that's important. It really enhances differentiation towards the myeloid lineage and seems to make them resistant to apoptosis. The other thing that they seem to do is turn on this gene called beta-catenin that we heard about earlier, and it's really important for regeneration of normal hematopoietic stem cells. And what we know is that if it goes to the nucleus in its non-phosphorylated form, it can turn on transcription of key target genes such as cyclin D1 and c-MYC. So as you can see here in the blast crisis GMP, they have high-level nuclear beta-catenin with beta-catenin labeled in red and the nucleus in blue, compared to normal GMP that really don't have much nuclear beta-catenin. That beta-catenin is transcriptionally active. It turns on this left TCF reporter gene and gives rise to these bright green colonies. So we wondered, is that important for establishing these cells in vivo? Can these, what should be committed progenitors, inappropriately self-renew in vivo? So we set up this model, and again, this was work done by Annalie Abramson and Yifat Giron in the lab primarily, and more recently with the help of Kim Hyun Dao and Edward Kavalerichik and Daniel Goff. So it's a big effort in the lab. Anyway, what we found was after transplanting these cells, the 34 positive, 38 negative cells, versus the 34 positive, 38 positive cells, was it was these more committed progenitors that had the enhanced capacity to regenerate leukemia in vivo, partly because they really overexpressed activated beta-catenin. The stem cell-enriched compartment, the 34 positive, 38 negative fraction, seemed to be losing steam over that time. The other thing we noticed, actually, Ani noticed this in the lab, because I thought this mouse looked okay. And she said, are you kidding me? This is a really sick mouse. So anyway, we noticed, or Ani noticed initially, that these mice were forming tumors, which sort of surprised me, because when I did my first bone marrow transplant fellowship in Vancouver, we used to see people with what were called granulocytic sarcomas. So this was at the end of 1998, pre-Gleevec. So that's when people would come in with these extraordinarily high blast counts, and they would get solid tumors made out of their leukemia under the skin. And that's exactly what these mice get. So these tumors are bioluminescent because we tagged the cells with luciferase prior to putting them in. They're primarily composed of human myeloid cells. As you can see, they're highly angiogenic, have these early neutrophils, and they're BCR-ABL positive. As you can see, this is just six different tumors where we did PCR for BCR-ABL. They're also highly engrafted in the thymus, spleen, liver, and bone marrow. Now, what we found in further analysis, it was the GMP that had the highest bioluminescent engraftment. We could get down to about 1,000 cells and get leukemic engraftment, and they had serial transplantation potential, as shown by recapitulation of leukemia in secondary transplant recipients. And we've gone out to the fourth and fifth transplant generation, and it's really that population that can do that. Now, just in the last few slides, I wanted to mention that recently, we've been looking at why does beta-catenin get activated. It looks like in 57% of patients, we have a missplice in one of the major negative regulators of the pathway called GSK3-beta, where it deletes the AXIN2 binding site. So they really can't inactivate beta-catenin adequately. If we overexpress the full-length GSK3-beta, we're able to overcome that phenotype and inhibit engraftment and then turn down beta-catenin expression. We have a compound in the lab, thanks to work done by Ted Malinsky at SIO, together with Wolfgang Rosidlo, that seems to decrease engraftment of this leukemic stem cell population, shown here as the GMP, by about 50% in early studies. The other thing I wanted to mention very briefly is that it's not all about beta-catenin. GSK3-beta happens to be the nexus. It is the regulator of a number of pathways, and there appears to be crosstalk between the Wnt pathway and sonic hedgehog pathway. So Annalie Abramson in the lab has been working on using a sonic hedgehog inhibitor together with a BCR-ABL inhibitor to see if this is better at eradicating the leukemic stem cells. And it looks like there is high Cle1 expression, which is a sonic hedgehog target gene, in the leukemic stem cells. We can't eradicate them with dasatinib, but it looks like a combination of a sonic hedgehog inhibitor and dasatinib may be more effective. The other thing is we've been looking at survival pathways in these cells. This is Daniel Goff in the lab. And it looks like the splice isoform that promotes cell death or apoptosis in one of the BCL2 family members called MCL1 is really down-regulated in the tumors. So they like to survive. They've got a major defect there. So in one of the last slides, I'd just like to say in CML, you can see that a number of genetic and epigenetic events lead to progression, and that we can intervene at any one of these points, provided we know that people are progressing. So we need more sensitive diagnostic tests to be able to do this. And we need to be able to model the disease to understand the functional hierarchy among these molecular events to understand which is most important in the molecular pathogenesis of the disease. So this is work done by Jessica Russert that we're collaborating with in Larry Goldstein's lab to trace embryonic stem cell differentiation in vitro and in vivo and add the genes of interest, BCR-ABL and beta-catenin that Edward Kavalerchik's doing, again tagged with GFP, and putting them into the same mouse model to see if we can get hematopoietic engraftment and to see if we can skew differentiation by introduction of an oncogene such as BCR-ABL and enhance hematopoietic engraftment in vivo and check to see that they're really human using human nuclear antigen. Overexpression of beta-catenin may enhance CD34 engraftment in these mice. And here you see CD45 staining in the liver. That's Edward Kavalerchik's work. So this is the last slide. I just wanted to say that we need to understand not just malignant hematopoiesis, but normal hematopoiesis and how these events matter during the context of hematopoietic stem cell differentiation into more committed progenitors so that we can prevent this aberrant reprogramming that happens not just in hematopoietic malignancies, but in a number of cancers. So what we'd really like to come up with is highly active anti-leukemic stem cell therapy that blocks this abnormal differentiation, survival, self-renewal, and homing of these leukemic stem cells, and see if our discoveries here may be more broadly referable to other cancer stem cell populations. So I'd like to thank the people in the lab that did the work that I talked about, particularly Ifat Giron and Anneli Abramson, who worked on the initial work that I talked about together with Edward Kavalerchik, who was funded by CIRM, and Kim Hyem Dao, who's also funded by CIRM. So we're very grateful to CIRM, as you can tell. This is very important for our patients. I was at a Leukemia Lymphoma Society meeting yesterday in Kansas City, and people were starting to think about the questions that CIRM has allowed us to tackle, the really hard things that have really important implications for clinical trials. And so we don't have to think about them, we're actually allowed to do them. So this is an amazing boon for not just patients, but potentially science and also for the economy, I think. Anyway, so I'd like to thank Irv Weissman for collaborating on GSK3-beta and also Larry Goldstein for his tremendous support. And also say it's more fun if we do this together.